I desire above all things that we might experience what David wrote in Psalm 34. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. I want that above everything to be the experience that we'd have tonight and tomorrow afternoon. You see, I was born into a very wealthy family in Northern California. We had a large ranching operation, dairy herds, and all kinds of fruit orchards, grape vineyards, hay fields. We had everything in the world that one could want on a ranch. That was only a hobby for my father, for he was a building contractor. He built hotels in San Francisco and Oakland, and the ranching operations were just his plaything for the weekends. We lived in a huge home with wealth all around us, a great library in our home. We had everything in the world that one could desire except the Lord Jesus Christ. My father was the son of a Methodist minister. My mother came from a very professional family in medicine and education. Both of these people were quite religious, very religious in their youth, but somehow they separated themselves from the Lord Jesus and forgot him. And so five boys grew up without even knowing that God existed. In addition to that, we had a boat harbor as well. I suppose if you were to buy all the things we had, it'd take about $17 million. And God took it all away. And oh, I am so grateful that we no longer have the Harris contracting firm, no longer the Harris ranching operations, and no longer the Harris boat harbor. God took it all away, and we moved into a tiny little one-room shack on the levee of a river. And I was, I think, 9 or 10 years of age when I first heard the name God, other than in cursing. I knew absolutely nothing spiritual. My father seemed to have a Midas touch in everything that he connected himself with, and the contracting business kind of came back to a degree. And through those years, again, I heard nothing of the Word of God except in cursing and blasphemy. Only that one time when I was 9 or 10 had I heard something about God in heaven. I attended Mass, you see. I tried to steal the offering. Got hit on the head by a deacon. Had to put the money back in the container. And that's about all I knew about religion. It was a place where you got hit on the head. You had to give back the money you tried to steal. And it was a funny looking place anyway. When I entered into the Air Force in the beginning of World War II, I went, you see, without any spiritual reserves, because I didn't know anything. And when you're tossed into that kind of environment, you can believe me, if you don't have spiritual qualities or spiritual reserves to draw on, there's no way you're going to find your way out of that kind of a mess except by a miracle of God. When I went into the Air Force, I was sent down to Biloxi, Mississippi. And I took my basic training there, and then I was sent to Lincoln, Nebraska, where I took a specialized aircraft, airframe, and mechanics course in preparation for flight engineers training at Boeing Aircraft. And while I was in Lincoln, one of the fellows in my barracks took a very keen interest in me. He saw I needed God very, very desperately, and one day he came to me, and he said, "Harris, why don't you read this?" And he handed me a Bible. And I said, "What's that?" Well, he said, "It's the Bible." I said, "What's the Bible?" You know, I didn't even know what a Bible was. I'd never seen one in my life. He said, "Well, it's the Word of God." "Well, who's God?" "Why, he created you." "God never created me. We came from the monkeys." Now, that's what I had learned in school and in my science classes. "Oh," he said, no, "God created you. And if you read this book, you'll find out about it." Well, I was a very avid reader, and I opened the Bible up and I began reading, "In the beginning, God created." Well, I read through those few verses about creation, and I got stuck in the these and thous, the old English, and I closed the book, and I just didn't have the slightest bit of interest in that kind of a story about creation. Well, this fellow was not easily turned aside, and he was at my side just a few days later, and he said, "Harris, why don't you come to the chapel with me and hear Chaplain Payne?" And that's probably what it would be. All right, it's a great big pain hearing that fellow. I didn't know what a chapel really was. I had never been inside of one, but I thought there was a lot of hocus-pocus that went on in those kind of places, and I didn't want to be a part of it.
Well, he kept pressuring and pressuring. You know how people can do that. And I got mad at him. And I doubled up my fist and I said, Gilbert Henry, if you don't shut up, I'm going to put my fist right down your throat. If you do shut up, I'll go with you. You know, I thought I'd scare him off like that. Oh, he said, I'll shut right up. Well, at 7:15 on that Sunday evening, he was standing right there next to my bunk. And he said, okay, Harris, it's time to go. I said, go where? Well, you promised to come to the chapel with me. Well, young people, my father, with all of his deficiencies, had one exceptional quality. He was a man of his word. And he taught us five boys that whatever you say you're going to do, you do it. Your word is your bond. You need no contract. Your word is your bond. Now, that's how he built hotels, without contracts, only his word. And he instilled that very deeply in us. Well, I was stuck. I promised to go, so go I had to do. And I went into the chapel with him, and wouldn't you know there were only two seats left in that whole chapel, and they were halfway back on the right side, and Gilbert Henry spotted those two seats, and he had me into one before I could turn around and run out the door. And just at that moment, Chaplain Payne raced onto the platform. Now, this man ran everywhere he went. He ran out of the side room there in the chancel, onto the platform, and he opened up the Bible, and he began preaching my land about things I'd never heard of in my life. About down under the ground were great boiling cauldrons of oil. And down there were all of the sinners were. And the devil was down there with a big pitchfork. And he was sticking the sinners with the pitchfork and he was chucking them into a big pot of oil. And they would roast and burn there for a few million years. And when that cooled off a little bit, he'd take them out with a pitchfork and stick them in another one 10 times hotter. Now that's what this man was preaching from the pulpit. In my land, I said to my God, I never heard of those kind of things being down under the ground. I didn't know they were there. And then he talked about heaven. And all of the saints, whoever they were floating around on the edge of clouds playing harps. And I thought, good night, what a place that must be, sitting on the edge of a cloud playing a harp for millions of years. And I didn't know which was worse, to do that or be down there. And when he finished his sermon, he made a call. And he said, stand up. And that was an officer's order, so we all had to stand up. And he said, I dare you sinners, it looked like he pointed right at me, I dare you sinners to come right down that aisle and go into that room over there. Well, before I knew what happened, Gilbert Henry had me by the back of my pants, and he was heavier than I was, and he shoved me out into the aisle and shoved me stumbling up that aisle. I was trying to turn around to get him to kill him so I could get out of that crazy place. And he pushed me stumbling up over the steps and into that room. And 3 or 4 other sinners got in that room there with me too. And Chaplain Payne came running in. And he got hold of my hand and began shaking it very vigorously. And he said, I'm so glad you've given your heart to the Lord. And I said, what are you talking about, giving my heart to the Lord? I didn't give it to anybody. Well, when we left there, that room, I was so angry with Gilbert Henry, I was just waiting to get him outside so I could actually kill him. Well, he was so elated with my conversion that I couldn't hit him. He was just too happy. And I couldn't hit a fellow that thrilled and happy. Well, when we got back to the barracks, within 15 minutes, he was terribly discouraged because I hadn't been converted. Well, do you know that the next Saturday night, he was right back at my side again. And he said, you've got to come and hear Chaplain Payne, and I'm not going near that idiot. He said, you've got to come and hear what he says next week. And I got angry with him again after what he had done to me. And then this pressure again. And again, I gave him the fist. And I said, if you don't shut up, I'm just going to really smash your one. He said, I'll shut up if you'll go with me. I'll go with you, I said, just to keep you quiet. Well, I was stuck again without knowing what I had said. But again, my word was my bond. And lo and behold, on Sunday at 7:15, he was right there at my bunk claiming my promise. So back we went to hear Chaplain Payne. We sat about in the same place. He ran onto the platform and he preached a sermon 10 times hotter. And he had everybody stand up again. The same call was made and that crazy Gilbert Henry got me by the back of my pants and he shoved me out there again and stumbling up the steps and into the room. And the second time Chaplain Payne came through shaking my hand along with those other sinners that got in there with me and saying how delighted he was that we had given our hearts to the Lord. Again, the elation of Gilbert made it impossible for me to hit him. But I was worried when I went back to the barracks. He scared me about that boiling oil down there where hell was located. That's the first time I ever heard of that place. Second time I'd ever heard of that place. Hell, I thought, was just a cursing word. Not a literal place, as it were. And I was afraid when I got to my bunk. And I said, I better make some kind of a choice. I don't want to go down there and burn. That hurts. At least it wouldn't hurt sitting on the edge of a cloud playing a harp. But I don't want to do that either. And I had a little bit of a tussle in my heart. And when he came on Sunday evening the third week, I said, I'll go with you, before he could say anything. Well, Chaplain Payne preached the same kind of a sermon the third week. And when he made the call, I beat Gilbert Henry to the jump and I was out on the aisle. And I voluntarily went into the room. Now, three times in a row looking at me, Chaplain Payne stopped. And he said, I'm so glad you've given your heart to the Lord again. It's time for you to be baptized. I said, what's that? Oh, he said, we'll take you to the church in Lincoln. This is the city church. And we'll put you in a big tank of water, and I'll put you under the water, and you will die. Die? Yes, you will die. The old man will die, and I'll raise you up out of the water, and you'll be a new creation. He said, no, you don't, Chaplain. You're not going to play that hocus-pocus with me. I might get down there by accident, and you're not going to baptize me. And I ran out of the church and never went back again. Wouldn't you know that that's the way the devil would introduce someone to the Lord? In as difficult, in as disordered and ugly way as possible. So I fled away, never to return. Well, my training was over there, and I went up to Boeing Aircraft. There I took my flight engineering on B-17s. And all crews had to take gunnery training, and I came down here to Arizona to Kingman. And there I took all of my ground gunnery, and then we were sent out to that wondrous place called Yucca. And Yucca then had four houses and a railroad track right in between them. It was a place of isolation, the backside of the desert. And while I was lying on my bunk, a wonderful young Baptist boy came by and he handed me a book. And he said, Harris, why don't you read this? It's a terrific adventure story. What is it? It's about a man who was a terrible sinner who became a saint. It was a storybook in the life of Charles Fuller, the one-time speaker of the old-fashioned revival hour. That's really no more. So I lay on my bunk and I roared through that book and I was really impressed. It was Sunday evening. And he had given me an invitation. Why don't you come over to the chapel tonight? And I said to myself, I'll never go in one of those crazy places again. But when I finished reading about that man who was changed, who was so much like me, I so much like him, that I decided I'd go. I just felt impressed. Go to the chapel. So I rolled off my bunk into a uniform and I started off to the chapel. Walking across the parade ground, which was of immense size, and halfway across, God spoke to me. Now this is the only time I can recall in my life where the voice of God has come audibly. And when he spoke, it was like a clap of thunder. And like lightning, and like glory. And when God spoke, I stopped stunned in the middle of the parade ground. And he simply said, I want you for a minister. And when I stopped at the sound of those words, I was immobilized, I was paralyzed with fright, and I turned and looked all around to see who had spoken. But there wasn't a soul within a half a mile of me. I was alone out under the desert sky. I want you for a minister. Well, when I recovered from it all, I quickly made my way to the chapel, and inside were five fellows. This was on a Wednesday night. Five fellows were down in the front row, and they were reading from Matthew. And they would read a verse and discuss it, read a verse and discuss it. And I sat behind them. And suddenly I felt a seething rage swelling up in my heart. You see, the devil was not about to let me go. A seething rage welling up, and suddenly I jumped to my feet and raced out of the chapel, never ever to return again to any chapel. Well, the training was over and we were sent down to Florida, and the devil was right there again. In those days, when a crew was made up, there were 10 lines, a line of pilots, co-pilots, navigators, bombardiers, engineers, radio operators, and then gunners. 10 lines. And the first man off of the front of each line, that made up a crew of 10. And I'll tell you, the Lord tried, I'm sure, but the devil was present in the selection of our crew. What a motley, miserable crowd of 10 fellows. You've never seen the like of it. The pilot, he washed out flying fighter planes and they put him on a 4-engine bomber. He couldn't run one engine, so he had 4 to run now. And what a crazy pilot he was. He couldn't fly worth anything. When we'd come in for a landing, you never knew what was going to happen. Sometimes we'd hopscotch down the runway with giant 10 and 12 foot jumps. And the navigator, he was a washed out pilot, so they put him in a navigational school. And we never knew where the world we were with him. We went down to Cuba once and we couldn't find Florida again. We got it by accident, quite by accident. He put us into a bomb running in 180 degrees off one night. We flew into the formation in reverse. Here they were coming at us and we flew right into it, passing bombers above and below and all around us. We never really knew where the world we were with that fellow. The co-pilot, he was sharp. He was good. Three of the four gunners were washed out pilots also. So everybody was mad at the Air Force because they were washed out pilots and everything we did was crazy. One day we were flying on a training mission down there in Florida and an engine caught on fire. And the thing was a fierce flame and it was so hot that the engine nacelle melted on the wing and hung down under the wing. Well, quick as a flash, half of the crew bailed out without even getting a bailout signal. The fire was put out very quickly, and the plane landed very safely, but they jumped out just for the kicks of jumping. You know, that was the kind of a crew we had. When our training was finally finished, we picked up a new B-17, and we were eager to go into war. I wanted to go into war and to fight and to kill. That's what I've been trained for. You know, even today, I must catch myself. The urge to kill can come so quickly when you're under pressure. It's a terrible thing to carry with you always. The instant response, as I say the urge to kill, it's actually the response. It's an instantaneous response. Instantly. When you've been trained to do it, you never forget it. So we picked up our new B-17 bomber and finished up our final phases of training, getting the plane ready to go, and we flew up the East Coast over to Newfoundland. And wonder of wonders, we found Ireland. We didn't find our base. We missed that completely. He had navigated us off down to Southern Ireland, and we finally made our way back up to Northern Ireland. We got there quite by accident, I'm sure. And when we landed, there at the end of the runway was a Jeep with a big sign on it, "Follow Me." So we obediently followed the Jeep around onto a taxi strip into a hard stand. The engines were shut down. A couple of officers jumped off of the Jeep and came on board and on the interphone system very sternly said, "Get your gear and get off." I said, "Man alive, get our gear and get off. We've brought this plane over to go into combat. Get your gear and off," he said again. So we obeyed and off came our gear. And in a few moments, the engines were turning again and the plane flew off to England. Now we're in Ireland without a plane. So the guessing began. The plane was being taken away to camouflage and getting ready for combat and all the rest of it. We'll get it again. We wanted to take that new aircraft, which was really a flying fortress, into combat. After a week in Ireland, we were flown over to Scotland. No plane. Then down to Polbrook to the 509th Bomb Squadron. No plane. The first thing when we arrived there, we wanted to know, where is our aircraft? Is it here? And the crew chief wouldn't answer us. He said, "Get in the Jeep and we'll take you out to your plane." So we went around the circular part of the field and on the roadway, and we started passing the aircraft. All the new aircraft were up in the front. I was looking for her serial number, and she wasn't there with the new ones. And it was a terrible disappointment. Then we came to the aircraft that would be considered good quality. And we passed all of those, and then we came to the fair quality aircraft, and then we came down to the junkyard, and we came to the last hard stand. And we turned in, and there sat my princess. And as we rolled up to my princess, I looked at the name painted up there on her nose, that my princess, my foot, what a pile of junk. Well, you see, the thing was down there at the junkyard to be stripped of any usable parts, and that was the end of my princess. But as I stepped off the Jeep and began looking at that aircraft, I saw a kind of a crazy quilt pattern all over the wings and the fuselage. And as I stepped closer, I saw that these funny, crazy quilt-looking patterns were pieces of aluminum, circular pieces, square rectangles, riveted into places where bullets had gone through her fuselage and wings, and pieces of flak had torn their way through. And then I stepped back and looked up under the pilot's window, and I started counting bombs. You see, every time an aircraft went on a raid and returned, the bomb was painted on the fuselage, indicating how many raids the aircraft had made. Normally, an aircraft and a crew are expected to make 8 to 10 raids, then you'd be dead, the aircraft gone. Our life expectancy was 8 to 10 raids, that's all. And I started counting bombs. 10, 20, 30, 40, 5, 6. 46 bombs were painted on the fuselage under the pilot's window. And then I could understand why all of the flak. You see, she had gone 4 times beyond what she was supposed to do. As I climbed on board the aircraft through the waste compartment entrance, I saw very ancient equipment. This was one of the first models of the B-17. She had trained hundreds of crews. I suppose that plane must have had close to 50,000 hours of flight time, which was a great deal for those days. As I passed the machine guns, I could see where the abrasive materials on the floor that the gunner stood on, which would keep him from slipping, was all worn off. The shackles that held the guns into place were worn terribly. I passed the ball gunner's turret, and as I looked down on the great 48-inch ring which held that gun turret in the aircraft with 48 bolts, 1 inch in diameter and 6 inches long, I saw that those bolts were all rusted solidly. And I said to myself, boy, if we ever have to try to drop this gun turret, when we lose power on our engines, we'll never do it. Little did I realize that that would come true. I stepped into the radio operator's room, and the seats were so worn that he sat on that the springs were sticking out through the upholstery, and old ancient equipment in the banks there of radio gear. Then I stepped into the bomb bay. And as I stood on the catwalk, I looked at the bomb shackles. These were worn half in two. And I had been on aircraft many, many times with shackles like that, and they would often get hung up. One shackle would release, one shackle would hold, and there was your bomb dangling, fully armed, in the bomb bay. And at 30,000 feet, we'd have to get out on that catwalk and kick the bomb loose. And here was a plane with all shackles half worn in two. She had dropped thousands of bombs. And that makes me think of our bombardier. I don't know how in the world, as a washed-out pilot, how he ever passed bombardier's training. He couldn't hit anything, except when he was fooling around. And we had an island that we bombed off of the Florida coast as a target, but he would always pick banana boats to see how close he could drop a bomb and nearly blow them out of the water. And he did it almost every practice mission we made. One day he dropped 18 bombs in Tampa Bay and blew all the windows out of those great mansions along that beautiful harbor. Well, I was thinking of him as I stood on that catwalk. Then I slipped up onto the flight deck and into the co-pilot's seat, picked up the charts, and to my dismay, I found that our aircraft was 550 hours beyond overhaul time, as the engine should have been pulled off for complete overhaul 550 hours previously. The crew chief came on board, and as he stood next to my seat, I looked up into his face and I said, "Does this thing run?" He said, "Well, yes, sir, it runs, but not very well." Well, a pilot came on board along with a co-pilot, and we started up the engine. They sounded like hay balers. The clanking was terrible. We taxied our way down to the strip and revved the engines up to full power, which wasn't very much power, but it was all those engines could produce, released the brakes. And it took 5,000 feet of 5,500 to get it in the air. empty. And I wonder, what in the world are we going to do when we have this thing loaded with bombs and fuel? We flew it for about an hour and a half, and I thought it, frankly, was going to fall apart. But this was a very critical time of the war, and every plane had to fly, and so my Princess was pressed back into service, and we came in as a replacement crew for somebody who was shot down a few days before. We flew my Princess for about 3 weeks, and then one day the grapevine began leaking the message that the next day was to be a maximum effort air raid on the city of Berlin. That was the rumor. A maximum effort air raid was a very dangerous and critical thing. It meant that usually about 1,000 Yankee planes and 1,000 British planes would bomb one single target for 24 hours. The British would bomb all night and the Yanks would bomb all day. 24 hours nonstop. Now, that was a rumor that it was going to be a maximum effort raid. And, of course, Berlin was guessed, and Dresden was guessed, and Cologne was guessed, and all kinds of targets. And whenever that kind of an announcement came, everybody got really nervous. And my crew was no exception, so down to the PX we went, and we decided to drown our fears in drink, and so everybody got drunk there at the PX. And after we had been there for a few hours, we decided we'd go to a movie. And we had an old tent pitched in the woods next to our barracks. And we took in a couple of movies, and about 11 o'clock that evening, we went back to the barracks. And as I opened a door in somewhat of an inebriated state, I saw a man standing next to my bunk, and he had all my uniforms laid out on the bunk. And he was in the process of putting on one of my shirts. He was just putting his arm down the sleeve. When I saw him doing that, and I was instantaneously aflame with anger. And I ran down to him and I yelled at him, "Hey, what are you doing putting on my shirt?" And very nonchalantly and quietly, he turned to me. And he said, "Fear not, Harris. You will never wear these clothes again." And with that, he put my shirt on my bed, turned away from me, and walked down three or four beds, and he was gone. I know it was an angel who had come to forewarn me that something was to happen and to make me think and to realize how feeble and how frail life really is. And I'll tell you, as I got into my sack, into my bed that night, I felt how frail and feeble life was. I couldn't sleep. All I could hear were those words, "You will never wear these clothes again." About 3 o'clock in the morning, the barracks chief came through blowing a whistle, ordering us out of our beds into our flight uniforms, down to the mess hall for breakfast, and into the briefing room. And I'll tell you, young people, as we went into that briefing room, there wasn't any goofing around. There were no wisecracks, no jokes. There were 550 deadly serious young men. You know, most of us were between 18 and 26 years of age. And as we sat in our seats waiting for the briefing to begin, the 55 crews, 550 of us, just a few whispers here and there, that's all. And the intelligence officers came onto the platform and they said, "Gentlemen, you're on a maximum effort raid." The rumor was right. And there was just 550 groans, because it meant a lot of us would not come back. A lot of us wouldn't come back. As the intelligence officers continued their briefing, they told us with an electrifying result, "Gentlemen, we have informed the enemy that you are coming." It was a psychological maneuver on the part of the intelligence people, I guess. But you can imagine what it did to us. And he said, "Furthermore, gentlemen, the enemy has prepared for you. Your target is Berlin." And with that, of course, our flight map and everything was on the screen in front of us, with a red line showing our base at Polbrook, running off across the North Sea through Holland, along the Baltic Sea, past Schoenemunde and down through Stettin, and then down to Berlin. And when we saw Berlin, there were just 550 more groans again. The intelligence officer said that our intelligence informs us that the Nazis have moved 600 flak guns into the city. Now, 600 guns to defend a city like Berlin doesn't sound like very much. But mind you, these were 88 and 105 millimeter guns. Each of them could shoot 2 shells per minute, which meant that 1,200 shells every 60 seconds would be exploding down the flight path that each squadron would take. Because we'd come in one squadron after another, and all those 600 guns would be concentrated right in on those 55 aircraft, 40 aircraft, 30 aircraft. Squadrons were of different sizes. You can imagine what the devastation would be. That's why everybody was petrified with fear. Well, a briefing was over, and we were on the trucks, and we were headed out to our aircraft. And when our truck pulled up in front of my Princess, and I jumped off, I saw the tires were half flat. And I thought, good night, what kind of a load are we carrying? Well, I did my external inspection. We pulled the props through, and I climbed on board through the waste compartment door. And there, piled up along the sides of the fuselage, were boxes of ammunition. Lying on the floor were spare machine guns. These are the big 50 caliber machine guns. As I walked past a ball gun turret, here were more boxes of ammunition piled up. And I looked at those rusted bolts once again. And I wondered, would this be the day? Into the radio room, and another machine gun lying on the floor, a spare one, as well as one sticking out through the top. Boxes of ammunition piled against the radio equipment. And then onto the catwalk in the bomb bay, and I think my heart must have... The speed-up was substantial without any doubt. There, suspended in the bomb bay, were 8 huge 500-pound... super high explosive bombs. These are 8 feet long and about 18 inches in diameter. On top of these were 2 8-foot-long canisters, each containing 100 phosphorus bombs. So we were carrying 208 bombs on board. Now the phosphorus was of very high quality, which could burn through several feet of concrete. Now, we were carrying a lethal load indeed, and as I slipped into the co-pilot's seat and picked up the charts, to my dismay, I found we were carrying 3,000 gallons of fuel. No one of the tires were half flat. And as I started up the engines, it sounded to me like the rattle and the clanking from number 3 engine was worse than ever. And the crew chief came on board. And as he stood next to my seat, I looked up into his face and I saw concern written all over his face. And suddenly, by impulse, I guess, I reached into my pocket and I took out my wallet and I handed it to him. And then from another pocket, I took this watch, which I received when I graduated from high school. And I handed that to him. And I saw tears beginning to run down his cheeks. Do you know what I was telling him? Wasn't coming back. That's what I was saying. Without a word. I wasn't coming back. And with the tears pouring down over his hardened cheeks, he dropped down between the pilot and co-pilot seat through a hatchway into the navigator's compartment, then out through an escape hatch behind the props. And that was the last I saw of him. I felt a weird sense of ill will among the crew. In a sense of an omen of ill things. The crew was on board. We received our signal. Everything was by lights because the Nazis would be listening. And they would know how many aircraft are taking off at any given time if it were by radio. They knew pretty well anyway from their own spies that were all around the air bases. And we got our signal to move off of the hard stand. And with the engines cranked up at quite a substantial power, my Princess began easing off of the hard stand, and as she moved, there was a high-pitched squeal coming out of the right strut, or wheel on the right strut. It was a high-pitched squeal. It had a weird omen attached to it, too. And all the way down the taxi strip, this was the case. We got to the end of the runway. 3 aircraft at a time would take off, one right behind the other. We got our green light from the tower, and with the throttles at war emergency power. Now, this is a superpower that the engines produce for about 15 minutes, and then the engines freeze. They get so hot, the pistons just freeze in the cylinders. They seize. And of course, that breaks the crank and everything flies all to pieces. And they're only good for about 15 minutes like that. So with superpower on, we started inching our way from our way down the runway. It seemed like an eternity when those brakes were released before she started moving. She was just shuddering and shaking. And as she mushed her way down the runway, I took my place behind the pilot's seat. He was a pilot that never watched his instruments. I had to watch his instruments as the engineer and tell him what was happening across the panel. He would remove one earphone from his helmet and I would shout into his ear what he wanted to know. And at this moment, he wanted to know airspeed. So I started calling at 70. At 70, we were halfway down the runway. That's how slow we were going. And then I was calling 80, 90. Now, we're at takeoff speed at 90. 100. And he started pulling back on the wheel, and my princess was going up and down. So we were going down a runway like this. As he pulled back on the wheel, she was just so heavily loaded, my princess could not take off. And when we reached the 5,000-foot level, he still hadn't throttled back. We were still going at, well, we're up to 120 miles an hour now. Well, this had happened all the time, and I didn't know it with those aircraft. The engineers, the ground engineers, built a 6-foot bump into the end of the runway. And we hit that thing going 120 miles an hour at the 5,300-foot mark, and it threw us into the air, releasing the wheel friction, and we were airborne. Now, how'd you like to take off like that? With 3,000 gallons of gasoline and 208 bombs on board. Well, we just nicked the top of some trees far off from the end of the runway, and we just mushed our way up. Oh, it was a terrible experience. We had some branches stuck on the wheels. As we retracted the wheels, the branches were sticking out, the leaves were sticking out. And we pulled our way up through the clouds, and then we began our rendezvous. Now, put 55 planes into formation takes a lot of doing. It takes a little time, and we went around and around, and we got into the formation. And wouldn't you know, we ended up with my princess in tail-end Charlie position. That's the last plane back in the formation, and the lowest one down. And if anybody ever gets shot down, it's tail-end Charlie. And here we were with the oldest plane on the base and in the most crucial position. They put us there, of course, because the plane was so old and unairworthy that we could drop out of the formation without spoiling it, I guess, the reason for it. We were bound and determined we were going to stay in that formation. We were not going to abort. We were running at full power just to stay in the formation, and those fellows were running at about, 3/4 of power. And they had to throttle back so that we could catch up with them, stay with them. We made our way across the North Sea and into Holland, and there we saw our first fighter planes, hundreds of them in the sky. But for some strange reason, they didn't close to attack. We followed along by Lübeck on the Baltic. More fighter planes, hundreds of them again, but they didn't close. We followed all the way across on the shores of the Baltic to Swinemünde. That was the huge naval base. A gigantic thing, and hundreds of planes came up, and oddly again, they didn't attack our squadron, but they took the squadron ahead of us and the one behind, and we flew through without any attack. Then we turned southwest, headed for Berlin, coming over Stettin. And as I looked out ahead, about 150 miles, I could see the great, enormous black cloud of smoke like an atomic blast over the top of the city. We were coming in at 11 o'clock in the morning, so the city had been bombed for 17 hours when we made our appearance. And the devastation was immense and catastrophic, and thus this great pile of smoke over the city. The bombs were armed when we were about 50 miles out. Everybody was in their positions for the attack that was sure to come because hundreds of fighter planes were up in the air taking the squadrons ahead of us and behind us. And as we came in closer and closer, we could see the individual puffs of smoke from the flak bursting. The 600 guns were doing their work. Planes were going down everywhere. And as we came into about 25 miles of the target, the fighter planes were taking on the squadron in front of us with intensity. And they broke off. Instead of coming back to us, they went around the perimeter of the flak and picked that squadron up as they came out. Well, in just a few moments, we were into the flak, and the bursts of 88 and 105 millimeter shells were throwing us all over the sky. Now, our intention was to pack in as tightly as possible with one wing almost into the fuselage of the plane next to you so that we'd have concentrated bombing. Those 550 bomb canisters would go down in one cluster. The Friedrichstrasse station was our target and the Gestapo headquarters. And as the bombs were released, in the midst of all of this tremendous flak, Tom Harmon, our ball gunner, turned his turret downward, and he watched this mass of 550 bombs. It was just like one solid block going down, and he was describing to us what was happening as it went down. As we were flying over the bombs, as you release them, they go at an angle. And so he was right on top of it, watching it with intensity and giving it all to us on our interphone system, and the bomb struck the target dead center. If you go to Berlin today, you can see what we did. The damage is still there. The Gestapo headquarters is no more. There's only a little brick wall about 2 feet high, tapering off for 30 feet to nothing, and that's all that was left of the place. It said that we probably killed about 2,500 people in that raid. I do not doubt it. Lazo's bombs exploded. The phosphorus blast came with a big white explosion. Then came the black blast of the very heavy explosives on the 8 bombs that we were carrying, and plus all of those of the other 54 planes. And it was just one great big pile of black and white smoke, and everything disappeared and disintegrated. And then Tom screamed as if he had been shot. And what he screamed told us the end had come. He simply screamed, "First burst, 600 feet. What it simply meant was that a radar-controlled flak unit of 5 guns had found tail in Charlie. We were throwing out bales of aluminum foil to throw the radar off as it trailed out behind us. These were long strips of aluminum foil. But the guns would trail back on the squadron to tail in Charlie and lock on, and that's what happened to us. And a second later, he screamed, 400 feet, 200 feet, and then the first burst got us. In the next few seconds, we had 8 direct hits. A couple in the nose, 3 engines were blown out, 1 in the waste compartment, 1 in the radio room. And then miracle number 1. The first of 8 miracles. One of the shells went through our left main wing tank, which still contained about 500 gallons of high octane, 100 octane fuel. It went right through the wing tank, 100 or 200 feet above us, and exploded, leaving a hole about 8 or 10 inches in diameter through that wing tank, and the 500 gallons of fuel began pouring out of the wing into the trailing edge of the wing and vaporizing over the 2 red-hot exhaust pipes. Now, by every law of physics, we should have exploded in midair. But by God's grace, now I know, my princess flew on. Then the engines began going. Engine 1, 2, 3 went out. We had engine number 4 left. As we rode our way out of the flak, the rest of the squadron flew right off and left us. That is, whatever was left of the squadron did. And there we were over the middle of the city of Berlin with one engine. The oxygen supply was completely cut off with the back of the aircraft. And as I wrestled my way down underneath the flight deck and grabbed hold of a canister of oxygen that had not been pierced by the flak, I carried it back to the rear of the plane with an emergency mask on. The men were dying in the back of the plane. Fortunately, they were brought back to consciousness again with the oxygen. And we began a very steep dive down to about 20,000 feet where we could start breathing again. You can't breathe well at 20,000, but you can survive. And then miracle number 2 occurred. I began firing red flares out of the flight deck for fighter assistance, and one P-38 came to our assistance. And as he made his way around our aircraft, giving us a visual inspection, from his radio came the words, "I don't know how you fellows are staying in the air. You look like a kitchen sieve." The plane was just blown full of holes, just shattered to bits. Everything was knocked out on it. The radio equipment, everything was gone. Navigational equipment, we were completely lost with any aid, so we needed the P-38. But miracle number 2 happened now. Hundreds of fighter planes were waiting for us as we came out of the flak, but not a single one close to attack. And do you know why? The day before, Hermann Göring, the Nazi air chief, issued an order that no fighter plane was to attack any bomber flying by itself that was crippled. Can you imagine that, the day before that order came? Why did it come? Well, because they were losing so many fighter planes attacking crippled bombers along the coast. We were getting such terrific fighter coverage. Nazis were losing too many fighter craft. So they elected not to attack any bomber that was already half blown to pieces because it wouldn't be usable again probably anyway. So that order came, saving our lives 100 times over the day before. You think it was a miracle? Boy, I do. We made our way, dropping down to about 9,000 feet, clear to the Dutch border, and we were arguing whether we should try to make a right turn and head for Sweden, because we knew we'd never get back to England. But to make that right turn would take power we didn't have, and we'd probably go down in the Baltic Sea. Or should we go straight ahead and go down in the North Sea and hope that the English would get to us with their patrol boats before the Nazis got to us out of Holland and Denmark? And while we were arguing back and forth what to do, we ran over another flak gun emplacement. 5 guns again started shooting at us. And as the shells pumped up into my Princess, the pilot lost control of the ship. We started over into a power dive, and we bailed out. Now, this is the first time I had ever bailed out. All I had ever had was an hour's instruction of what to do if you bail out. And to make matters worse, I had one of those miserable creations of the British, an overwater parachute. One of the most dangerous things ever made. You have a 6-inch strap between your legs, 2 over the shoulders, and a quick release mechanism on your chest. And you could actually wait with this parachute until your feet went into the water, hit the quick release mechanism, and the whole harness would fly off of you, and you'd go down into the water free of the shroud lines and of the silk. You could inflate your Mae West, which was a life jacket. You could pop to the surface, and you'd be free of all of that. Now, the standard parachute has a couple of straps between your legs. And they're more difficult to get out of than this quick release mechanism system. And here I had that miserable thing, the most dangerous chute in the world. That strap between your legs, if you had only a 0.5 inch of slack in it when you jumped and opened your chute, could split you into the lower abdominal section. A couple of inches could take you into the upper abdominal section. And anything beyond that could actually split you clear up to the collarbone. I had 6 inches of slack. And the slack was there because of crawling underneath the flight deck to get the oxygen canister. And I forgot to cinch the thing up. Well, now they told us in the parachute classes that when you jump out, well, there's nothing to it. You just jump out and you go down feet first and it's just beautiful sailing down. You can put your arm and leg out and go around that way and around that way. And there's nothing to it. Well, I'll tell you, when I stepped up to the door to jump out, everything went wrong. When I jumped out, the slipstream vacuum had me, pulled me out, and I was in a very tight spin going 1,000 per, I think. And I was sick in just a few moments of that very tight spin. And I remember, put your arm and leg out. So I put my arm and leg out, and I was in cartwheels from here downtown. I could just sick in reverse again. Oh, it was a terrible thing. And I ended up going towards the earth head first, which is the wrong way to go to open the parachute. But it was miracle number 3. You know, I tried to get out of that head first trajectory, which is at an angle like this towards the ground, and I couldn't move. I put my arm and leg out and I couldn't move. God had locked me into that position to save my life. And when I looked over my shoulder and saw the ground coming up fast, I thought it was just a few feet away from it. It was actually many thousands of feet. I pulled my ripcord and the parachute blasted out over my feet and my shoulders took the blow instead, saving my life. It only cracked one vertebrae, so that wasn't so bad. But as that parachute blasted over my feet and the riser cords yanked out to their full length, my shoulders, or the harness, acted as a hinge, and so I was flipped around the other way and went up in the air feet first, looking into the parachute down here, and then back around the other way and over there. Oh, boy, I was sick in a third direction now. As I drifted down towards the ground, I found myself going backwards. This is the wrong way to land. But God was working miracle number 4, unbeknownst to me. Now, you can turn your parachute around by crossing your harness straps, your riser cords, and letting them go, and that will turn the parachute around. But I didn't have any strength to even budge them. That tremendous blow sapped all of my strength. I didn't know that that could happen. A heavy blow will take your strength. In fact, that blow was so terrific it pulled one of my flying boots off. It was a zippered boot over an electric shoe and an electric uniform to my knees, so tight that it took one man to pull them off. And yet it snapped it right off of my foot. That's how savage the blow was. And as I drifted down towards the ground, we were getting ready now for miracle number 4. As I looked down, I was into the fields. We saw farmers working in the cabbage fields, and they were hoeing the weeds. And just below me, about 1,000 feet, was one of my crewmen, a gunner named Levy Pratt. Pratt was headed for one of those cabbage patches, and the farmers were working there in a great big circle, and they didn't know he was coming, and he didn't announce his coming with a "you look out, here I come" or anything. But some of the Land Watcher army members saw us coming. These are the old men, too old for military service, but good enough for the home guard type of service. And they started shooting at us. And the bullets went sailing past us and go through the parachute, and you'd hear the pop and then the sizzle of air going through the hole. And shooting like mad at us, poor Pratt was coming right down into the middle of all these people who didn't realize he was coming. And he landed in the middle of them, and he scared the wits out of them. They thought the paratroopers were coming, I guess, and they threw their hose in the air and ran out of the field. But a few moments later, they came back and very nearly killed him. And I turned my attention to see where I was landing, with a bullet zinging past. Fortunately, with the fall and the drift, we were a hard target. And wouldn't you know that I was headed for the biggest tree in Germany? A big walnut tree. And I tried pulling down on one of the riser cords to collapse the chute to drift away, and the harder I struggled, the more I went right into the center of the tree, it looked like. And sure enough, I hit the tree going backwards, which saved the more tender parts, the face and the abdomen. And I struck it with the heavier parts of my uniform and the flying, the electrically heated suit, which was a tremendously heavy thing. Fell through the branches without straddling any of them again, fortunately, and the parachute blossomed out over the top of the tree. The branches gave way as my weight took its toll on the tree, and I fell out through the bottom of it, and so snapped up into a horizontal position and then dropped 12 feet to the ground on my back. As the branches went back to their normal position, I was dragged across the ground and smashed against the trunk of the tree, paralyzed from the waist down. I was stunned from the blow on the head as well, and I lay against the trunk of the tree. I don't know how long I lay there, but I couldn't move my legs at all, and after a long while, I felt piercing pain shooting down my right leg. And I found I could move my foot just a bit, and then the pain started shooting down the left leg, and I could move my foot a bit again there. After a long while, I hit that quick release mechanism, the harness fell off, and I got hold of the riser cords and pulled myself up into a standing position, only able to shuffle my feet a few inches, and I started stumbling off across the field in the direction that I thought Pratt had come down, not knowing what had happened to him. And I got out into the field just a few yards, and I heard a voice shouting, "Comrade, comrade, come and see here!" And I turned around painfully, and standing under the tree were 3 men dressed in civilian clothing. And they were shouting, "Comrade," or "friend, come, come here, come and see here." And I shuffled my way back to them. And the one who stood in the center, he said, "Comrade, haben Sie," and he made the sign of a gun. And I didn't understand him. And he said, "Dutchman, Frenchman, Ruski, or Russian." And I, even in my dazed condition, I knew you wouldn't find a Dutchman, Frenchman, and a Russian running loose in Germany when they were all enemies of those people. They surely wouldn't be the underground, not that kind of a trio. And he kept asking, "Haben Sie, haben Sie," making a gun. "Do you have a gun?" And when I understood and said no, then smash came his fist into the face. And the beating followed with a club, a leaded club. My hand, with my left hand, was smashed. They jerked me around and dragged me down the little country lane. And there was Pratt standing in an intersection. The blood was gushing out of his mouth. He was cut and bruised terrifically. And as soon as I arrived, they decided to execute us. Then one said, "We cannot execute him without the Bürgermeister, or the mayor of the village from whence they came." And so a runner was sent off to the village to get the Bürgermeister to come to take charge of the execution, and the whole village came. Instead of taking us to the village to execute us, it was to be done in the country, because in the village there was a contingent of soldiers, and they would take us as prisoners of war. The civilians could not do that and kill us with the soldiers present, so the whole village came. And when the burgomaster came, he was very much a burgomaster, a big rotund fellow, and he took his place, and they began cursing us, calling us pig dogs, Schweinhund, gangster type, and Chicago gangsters, and everything else. And you can understand that the people would speak like that, because their country had been devastated. They had no part in the war. They were all old people living on their farms, and they didn't know what was happening with their own government, even out in that isolation where they were. So one could not blame them for reacting as they did. And the burgomaster selected the 10 leading citizens of the village to shoot us. 5 for each of us. And he had a terrible time selecting the 10 leading citizens for the honor. When he got them selected and the guns were handed to them, they lined up in a long row. In a row, I guess, about as wide as the center pews here. Pratt and I were pushed off about 30 feet from them. Pratt was so wounded he could hardly stand. I was in such terrific pain, hardly able to move my legs, that we had to hold each other to stand. And with all of the people shouting and screaming, pig dogs, gangster type, and Pratt and I were waiting to die. And I'll tell you, young people, I didn't want to die. I was only 20 years old. I wanted desperately to live. I had no hope. I could think of Chaplain Payne's boiling cauldrons of oil down under the ground. And I was scared, and I didn't want to die. So the burgomaster gave the commands. Ready? The guns came to a ready position. Aim. 5 at my chest and 5 at Pratt. And I'll tell you, my dear young people, I never, ever would want to face that kind of situation again without being a Christian. I have faced death several times in the mission field, but I had peace that I'd never want to face again without being a Christian, that firing squad. Ready? Aim. Fire! He screamed. Tomorrow afternoon, we'll tell you what happened.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you would discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.